Good morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for being here. Today, as you look at the agenda, we have some work sessions we're going to do first, and then we have a public hearing. There will be no work session today on Senate Bill 377, and Senate Bill 575 is only scheduled for a public hearing. The chair would like to have, I have show and tell today. My showing is my mentoree, which is Jennifer Lang Perkins. She's an attorney in Eugene, and she and I are participating under the Oregon State Bar's mentoring program.
Oh, cool.
She currently works for the Department of Human Services and Child Protective, and she's looking at what other things happen for attorneys besides working to protect kids. So, Jennifer, thank you for being here. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up our first work session with Senate Bill 381. Shauna?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, you heard Senate Bill 381 in committee on February 17th. This is the Oregon State Bar's Board of Governors bill. It deals with the membership of the Board of Governors, increasing it to 19 members, and it does some clarification on PLF contributions and timelines for delinquency of payment. You have the proposed Dash 2 amendments, which modify the function of the Board of Bar Examiners, requires the Supreme Court to appoint the Board of Bar Examiner members in accordance with the rules of the Supreme Court, and requires at least two public members. It specifies that the examiners are to carry out admission examinations of bar applicants in accordance with the bar bylaws and Supreme Court rules, and it includes investigation of applicants' character and fitness within their charge. We have the fiscal and revenue documents. There are no fiscal, no revenue on the Dash 2 amendments. It's ready to move should you choose to adopt those.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 381.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendment into Senate Bill 381. Discussion. One question, Shauna. The Dash 1s, were they incorporated into the Dash 2s?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, the Dash 1s removed the reference to the Board of Bar Examiners from the bill. The Dash 2s replaced them because these are the information that they want to have happen. And there's somebody here from the bar. Should you like more detail on exactly what the Dash 2s do?
All right. Anyone
need? Well, the question is, so we don't need the ones.
We don't need the ones. Okay. They're not good incorporated enough within. They just don't. They aren't needed.
All right. Any other discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries.
I move Senate Bill 381 as amended by the Dash 2 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 381 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Gelser, will you be our carrier on 381?
Sure thing.
Thank you. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 381. Open up a work session on House Bill 226A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, we had a hearing on this bill yesterday. At the time, you had a question on whether this bill solely applied to restitution rights of victims or whether it was broader. And we have done some investigating and looking, and this bill only applies to restitution rights of victims.
All right. So if y'all remember yesterday when we had that conversation, what we wanted to find out is if the estate was going to have the full, let's say, privileges of a victim status and be able to be engaged into the court proceedings as a living victim. And that is not the case. I do understand from what Chana said that Department of Justice got back to us and stated that this was exclusively for the purpose of restitution, so the estate can receive restitution if it's appropriate through the courts.
Okay.
All right, so with that clarification, any other comments or discussion?
Chair, I'll move House Bill 2226 and Gross to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2226A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And let's see.
Chair Przanski, if I might suggest that Senator Roblin be a carrier on this bill?
That'd be great. Senator Roblin will be the carrier if for some reason Senator Roblin isn't willing to do that. Senator Thatcher, will you be a backup?
Sure.
All right, with that, we'll close the the work session on Senate House Bill 2226A, and we're going to go ahead and open up our first public hearing on Senate Bill 377. Eric.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 377 is a committee bill that would modify the invasion of privacy statute. The proposed Dash 2 amendment completely replaces the measure. The Dash 2 amendment would modify Oregon's computer crime statute, which already makes it a Class C felony to use a computer for the purposes of committing an act of theft. The Dash 2 amendment would clarify that statute by adding the language theft of an intimate image to the statute. We do not have the fiscals on the Dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, if memory serves, this covers that little gap in the bill we previously passed. So
that's the plan. And so we're going to have three people I have listed here come up and give us more detail information. Aaron Knott, Tara Lawrence, and Gail Meyer. If y'all three would please come forward. Y'all are signed up. Well, they're coming up, and we'll pull another chair up if we need to do that. Is there anyone else that's here today who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 377?
I'll yield. If it's just in the desk,
you okay.
And I'll lead off if that's okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name's Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General and the Department of Justice, here in support of the Dash 2 amendments for Senate Bill 377. And Senator Cruz, you are correct. These amendments are in direct response to a hearing you heard a couple of weeks ago on Senate Bill 188. That was a Department of Justice proposal that has since cleared the Senate floor, which addressed what happened when pictures taken consensually are later uploaded on the internet without the consent of the person who is the subject of the photos. At that time, you heard testimony from Christina Gordon, who's seated at the far right, and she described a fact pattern where intimate images similar to those captured by Senate Bill 188 were taken without permission from her phone. And I was surprised to hear that wasn't covered by existing law, and after that hearing went back and did some digging, and in fact it was not and is not covered by existing law. The closest statute that we have, and the one that I believe is appropriate, is the computer crime statute, which basically says if you get into somebody else's computer, and computer is defined broadly, so it would include portable electronic devices, smartphones, all of that is within that definition. And you take items off of there, it constitutes a crime. But under the existing definition, that's only for theft, including but not limited to theft of proprietary information. And our read, which I believe was also the read of the law enforcement officials involved in Ms. Gordon's case, was that intimate images do not have the financial value necessary to establish the facts for a theft. You could debate whether you believe that on an individual basis, but the courts have not so far held that photos without more have financial value and therefore, you know, the theft wouldn't apply. So we're adding the definitions from SB 188 of an intimate image to the felony computer crime statute. It's a very simple fix. It doesn't create any new crimes, and I do think it will cover not just this case, but I'm sure you're all familiar with the 2014, the massive uploads of celebrity photos that were taken off of computers and phones. What I want to emphasize is while celebrities were targeted there, the methodology that was used to obtain those photos could happen to anyone, and this covers that conduct as well. So I think it's an important statutory provision, and I'm happy to take any questions.
All right, let's go ahead and get the rest of the testimony, and then we'll open up for questions for the whole panel. Who would like to go next?
I can go.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify again today. I have received such amazing support and interest in this, and it's very heartwarming, and the feeling is insurmountable than anything that I could have ever expected from this. So thank you so much for the interest and support with
Christina,
this case.
I need you to put your name on the record.
Yeah, sorry. For the record, my name is Christina Gordon. So I do support this amendment to the current bill as it is. I believe that it helps us update the existing law, and it matches the ever-changing technological terrain of ways in which someone can violate another person's privacy. We've started a really great discussion a couple weeks ago with Senate Bill 188. And I think that, you know, that case, I wouldn't necessarily have been eligible to be, you know, to have someone be prosecuted under that case, which is fine. I'm glad that we had that discussion. But this bill would have had me fit in there because of the fact pattern that matches to what the bill would be modified with. You know, so what had happened, if you'd like a reminder, was a supervisor accessed my iPhone by plugging it into his computer and stealing my images. He shared those with other employees, and that's the privilege and privacy and power that I won't get back. It slowly chipped away at that. You know, my case didn't have the intent or the harm that would fall under Senate Bill 188, but it was still deviant and grotesque. I think we can all agree. And I think that because I had gone to the Salem Police Department and their hands were tied, there's nothing they could do, even though I'm sure they wanted a different outcome, I was left with no options. So I think this is a great opportunity to keep the conversation going, kind of take care of the problem well-roundedly. And I think it goes and pairs together very well with Senate Bill 188.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course, thanks.
Tara?
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Tara Lawrence. I'm a former elected Sherman County District Attorney, and I currently am a crime victims represent crime victims. I have done so for the last 15 years. It's been an area of particular interest to me. I am a single mom raising two sons, and I'm here because I'm in support of this bill. I think it does a great job to address situations like the case involving the young lady that was the teenager over at Target over in Washington County, that while she was there just shopping with her parent, I believe it was her mother, this pervert took his phone and put it under her skirt. And so I think that you guys have done a great job to take a look at this and fix the loopholes that previously existed, because I think as citizens we would have assumed that it would have been a serious crime and should be classified as a felony. There's one little issue that I'd like you guys to maybe consider, I would like you to consider, is I noticed that House Bill 2536 makes it a felony if the victim is 18 years or younger, and Senate Bill 377 requires that the victim be 12 or under. I would encourage you to consider maybe adopting the language of 18 or under. Thank you.
Any questions? All right. Thank you all very much. Again, I'll ask, is there anyone else who wants to testify today on Senate Bill 377? Not seeing anyone, we're going to close.
Before we close, that may not be a bad suggestion.
We'll look at it. So we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 377. As already stated, we're not ready to move the bill because we don't have the physicals on the dash twos. We'll do another review of it and see what, if anything else, we might want to change. And I want to thank the Department of Justice for their work in bringing forward the language that we have. And I'll say again, I personally think that there's a value for those photographs. And I find it kind of hard that a court has taken a position that something that you can substantially have in your hand that has an image on it doesn't have some value. That's just a sidebar comment from the chair.
Mr. Chair, I would totally agree with that. It may be hard to put a financial value on it, but the other value on it is massive. So, we've dealt. You know, ignorance is bliss, Mr. Chair, and there's a lot of stuff going on the internet that I wasn't aware of until this session.
It's always a learning experience.
But there's some scary stuff out there.
All right. I think I went ahead and closed the hearing already. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 575.
Eric? Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 575 comes to this committee from Senator Shields. The bill would require a police officer to inform a person that they have the right to refuse a search when the officer seeks consent to search. The bill would require that the failure to inform the person be considered in determining whether that consent was voluntary. We do not have fiscals on this bill yet.
Okay, so I have two representatives that are here, Representative Vega Peterson and Representative Fredericks. Frederick, why don't y'all two come up? I also thought Senator Thompson is supposed to be here. Y'all two come on up. And so I don't see him in the audience, so we'll go ahead and go with you two. And I think what I also like to do is, Dave Fedanke, why don't you go ahead and come up if you are you going to give testimony? It looks like you're listed as compared to Kimberly. And y'all will be the first panel. So thank you all very much. And whoever wants to start off.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chair Przanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I'm the state representative from House District 47 in East Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 575 today. Senate Bill 575 is a solution to the reports that are collected by my office and also the City of Portland's Office of Equity and Human Rights that document invasive and unnecessary searches under the perception that consent was not optional and that refusal or failure to consent would lead to immediate consequences such as the impounding of a vehicle. This experience, unfortunately, is particularly common in communities in which relations with the police force is already strained. In Oregon, people of color and immigrants are three times more likely to be stopped. And once stopped, there is a 50% chance that they will be searched. Freedom from unreasonable search and seizure is a fundamental right. And there shouldn't be any gray area of perceived coercion between a voluntary consent and compulsion for reasonable cause. The solution is to clarify the conditions that constitute valid consent. Senate Bill 575 is a necessary tool, similar to Miranda rights, to let people know that consenting to a car search is optional so that they can make the most informed decision. This bill does two things. It requires a police officer to inform a person stopped for a traffic violation or upon suspicion of criminal activity that the person has a right to refuse a request to search a vehicle. It also provides that failure to inform is prima facie evidence of the involuntariness of consent. It's important to note that in places like Colorado, if there's a probable cause or a warrant, an officer can still consent a search. Excuse me, not just in Colorado, but we're not touching anything that has to do with the probable cause or warrant. That will still, there's nothing that's changing like that. But in Colorado, where we have a similar law, it stands as a double affirmative, and the search then has a better chance of actually holding up in court. This is just a simple and necessary step to provide both the community as well as law enforcement officers a clear understanding of voluntary consent. This understanding will help enhance public safety and also prevent inequities in searches while empowering law enforcement officials to carry out their duties in a safe and efficient manner. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify in Senate Bill 575, and I'm glad to answer any questions that you have.
All right. Can you hang on until we get Lou's testimony in the world?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. I'm not sure what your schedule is.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Senator Przanski and members of the committee, I really appreciate inviting me here. I'm Representative Lou Frederick from House District 43, North and Northeast Portland, and you're going to hear a common theme here. It's a very simple one. Freedom from unreasonable search and seizure is a fundamental right. It shouldn't be a gray area of perceived coercion between voluntary consent on one hand and compulsion for reasonable cause on the other. And this bill would help clarify the conditions that constitute valid consent. As Representative Vega Peterson mentioned, my office gets calls and reports from persons. And I want to make sure that I use that term on purpose because we're talking about rights to personal safety and privacy that are based on personhood and no more. We receive reports that have been submitted that they felt were invasive and unnecessary searches due to a perception that consent was not optional and that refusal or failure to consent would lead to immediate consequences. In many cases, it's the impoundment of a vehicle. This experience is particularly common among in communities in which relations with the police force are already strained. It's also common among immigrants and refugees who may come from authoritarian environments, and that is places with lesser perceptions, protections from invasive demands from authorities and that we believe we enjoy as Americans. In many of our communities, especially in my community, quite frankly, trust in the police function is shredded. The destruction of trust that occurs with every interaction in which coercion is perceived is very difficult to undo. It leads to the generalized problem that in these same communities, encounters with police are escalated before they begin, with both police and citizens on high alert as an encounter begins, and this makes that interaction more dangerous for all parties. This bill does not confer any new rights. It only requires the police to inform the potential subject of a search of the rights they have. There is nothing better for de-escalating a tense situation than to pause to make sure that everyone is on the same page. Now, I'm not one to micromanage a profession that is not my own, and I think that the instincts of a good and thoughtful officer are the best resource to protect the public. But there are a few practices that ought to be legislated, and this is one of them. Our communities are in a deficit when it comes to trust in our protectors, and it will take an abundance of care and transparency to rebuild that bank. I really cannot finish my testimony without mentioning that stops and searches are not equal opportunity experiences. How many of you have been stopped for a tiny hole in the taillight? I have. How many of you have been stopped for failure to signal soon enough? I have. For seeming to be lost in my own neighborhood because it's now very gentrified. How many of you have been stopped without being given any reason at all? I have. We all know that in Oregon, people of color and immigrants are 3 times as likely to be stopped as European Americans, and when searched, about 1/3 is likely to be carrying contraband. I'm here to tell you that as a black man in America, that traffic stops and exercises are exercises in controlled terror. Searches are not mere inconveniences, they are major invasions. You're minding your own business and on your way home, you get stopped on a pretext, you're already feeling violated, you already feel powerless and vulnerable, and the officer implies that the only way you may be sent on your way is to consent to further violation. Multiply this by every person of color, and the accumulation of fear and vulnerability in the community takes a life of its own. This bill just mandates that before a search can take place without a warrant or probable cause, everybody involved pauses for a reminder of what an American's rights are. I think we all hope that that also means that everybody involved will take a breath. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask for the representatives. I'm not sure what your duties are. Can you say while we take Fernanke's testimony and then questions, or do you all want questions now?
I'm in another committee right now, if that's possible.
For either of the representatives. Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon. While Senate Bill 575 was introduced at the request of the Center for Intercultural Organizing, and I understand they are here to testify this morning, I wanted the committee to be aware that this proposal, at least in principle, has long been a goal of the ACLU of Oregon to achieve in Oregon. I circulated to the committee this morning a copy of a statute which has been on the books in Oregon since 1993, I believe, although the copy I have circulated to you pegs it with a 2009 date. This statute, which requires notice of the right to refuse consent in a stop where a civil forfeiture seizure may occur, was moved out of a section of the statutes that have been sunsetted off and on since 1989 and finally made permanent in 2005 and then moved in 2009, if my memory is serving me correctly. So the proposal in front of you today is not unprecedented. And the statute 131A.025 which deals with seizures for the purpose of civil forfeiture, was adopted because of a program that had been implemented by the Oregon State Police in the early 1990s. That was a drug interdiction program, primarily on Interstate 5 and Highway 97 on the other side of the Cascades, but was also used on other state highways, where a group of officers were trained in the profile, and I put that in quotes, to look for drug runners. And the theory was that the drugs were coming north from Southern California and Mexico at that time, and the cash was going south after the drugs were dropped off. And what we found in the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee at that time was a pattern of cases where the state police had carried out searches on Hispanic drivers and were seizing small as well as somewhat large amounts of cash from vehicles that were traveling south. Now, at the time, many migrant workers went back and forth between the Northwest and Southern California, and even sometimes back to Mexico outside of planting and harvesting seasons. There was much more traffic back and forth across the border in those days. When asked about this program, the state police justified these seizures of cash where there was no drugs present in the vehicles on the basis of this assumption that anyone who had cash that was driving south and was Latino was obviously involved with drugs. There was no understanding on the part of these officers that many people in the Latino community at that time did not have bank accounts, could not get bank accounts, did not trust bank accounts. And so most of the cash that was going back south represented their wages. And, of course, at that time, when property was seized for purposes of civil forfeiture, there was no requirement to arrest the individual from whom the property was taken, much less to convict them of any criminal offense. Now, of course, that has changed because of the passage of a constitutional amendment that tightened up civil forfeiture practices in Oregon in 2000. We came to the legislature in 1993 after this program had come to light. The state police had asked a few of the state police officers to go back through their notebooks and pull out the all of their traffic stops, break them out by race and ethnicity, look at those where searches had been done, what types of searches they were, and also whether contraband was found, including cash or drugs. And this was an unscientific sample, but it was five of the troopers who were most active in this program. And what that data showed was that not only were the cars of Latinos and other people of color much more likely to be subjected to consent searches, but that, in fact, even though there were a number of cases where cash had been seized and no arrests made, there were many more searches, consent searches, done on African-American and Latino drivers where nothing was found compared to white drivers. These troopers were quite good at spotting white drivers who were involved in criminal activity. Their hit rate for contraband when they did searches of vehicles driven by whites was over 50%. That's a pretty good definition of probable cause, even though most of those searches were consent searches. But in the cases of the Latino drivers in particular, they found contraband, and I include cash only in that number of contraband, in only 20% of the cases where they did searches. So I think you can imagine I hope you can imagine the impact on an individual who is stopped, usually on a pretext, in order because there is some suspicion they may be involved in illegal activity, and then subjected to a consent search that they don't understand they have the right to refuse, and then nothing is found, or their life savings at the moment are found and taken from them. This does not build positive relationships between law enforcement and the community that we believe they should be serving. Now, of course, many things have changed since the early 1990s. We have encouraged law enforcement agencies through state statute to voluntarily agree to collect traffic stop data on their practices, but only about a half a dozen law enforcement agencies in the state, including the state police, the city of Corvallis, the city of Hillsborough, the Portland Police Bureau, have collected traffic stop data for many, many years. That data continues in almost every instance to show a disparity between the outcomes of discretionary searches, especially those done on cars driven by Latinos and African Americans versus cars driven by whites. The reasons for this are still largely unknown. I know from talking to leadership in those law enforcement agencies, they believe their officers are not engaged in racial profiling, and yet in most cases we've been unable to identify what is going on here in these situations other than overly aggressive policing in our communities. The ACLU is pleased to be here this morning and encourage you to adopt Senate Bill 575. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Dave Fedenke. Don't see any. Dave, before you leave, because I want to also do an acknowledgement. Senator Farioli did this during our committee meeting last week. For many of the people here may not know, Dave Fedenke is in the process of retiring, and you've served as the director of Oregon ACLU for 22 years.
On staff for 33.
And I've had the opportunity to work with Dave through that process over the years that I've served in the legislature. And as Senator Farioli said, I want to thank you for your service to the state and everything that you've brought forward and ensuring that individuals have the ability to be represented when in many cases them themselves would never have that opportunity. So, Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and call up our next panel, which would be Gail Meyer, Simone, and Linda Roman. And while they're coming up, I have two other people that are scheduled to give testimony. Is there anyone besides Doug Harkerode and Michael Sobagio want to testify besides those two? Okay. Good morning. So whoever would like to start?
Sure. Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Salome Chimuku. I am the Public Policy Director and lobbyist for the Center for Intercultural Organizing. And many of you know me from my prior work here in the building, having held some of your offices as well. But my family immigrated here to the U.S. and to Oregon specifically in 1990, and I wanted to share something with you that you may not all know about me. So when I was a young girl, on a Saturday night, I wanted to go with my dad to work. Like many daughters, I kind of had an idealism of my father and wanted to see why he was gone from 5 p.m. till about 6 a.m. every day to provide for our family as a janitor. And so on a Saturday night, seeing as I didn't have school in the morning, but I did have church the next day, he took me with him to work. And I was just there to observe and watch him as he worked. We reached to our last facility that was in Washington County at the time. And when we were leaving the facility, it was common practice that we would carry the trash bags into the car and then from the car take them to the dumpster that was across the street. When pulling out of across the street, this is probably around 4 a.m.-ish, we were stopped by a law enforcement agent. Upon that stop, I, being a young kid, didn't know who this person was, but the first thing I did notice was a gun. So I just kind of hid in the back seat. My father talked with the man, explained that his name is Benjamin and he was the janitor for this facility. They asked for a license and registration. He provided it to the man quickly. And upon this conversation, he asked if he had proof if he was actually the janitor of the facility. And when my father couldn't prove that he was a janitor, because this was a dental facility, they didn't have like little badges for the night staff, he gave the person a number, but of course the supervisor did not answer because it's 4 o'clock in the morning. And the officer then asked him if he would step out of the vehicle so he may search the car. And my father didn't know that he was being asked a question, but did know that searching was going to be involved. And so he looked at me in the back seat because I wasn't invisible. Due to my young age, I was pretty bad at hiding. So he looked back at me and then looked at the officer and said, "Is a search necessary?" And then the officer responded with, "Are you saying no to a search?" And at that point, in my father's mind, he wasn't being asked to be searched. In his mind, he was saying either I comply with this search or I'd be arrested in front of my child. And so he complied, got out of the vehicle, asked me to get out with him. We both got out. The officer searched the vehicle and upon searching found the trash bags and ripped them open, try to see if there's anything in the bags. And when found nothing, told us that I told my father, you know, please make sure that next time you have some proof that you are the janitor here at this facility and things like this wouldn't happen again. And he left. But what folks don't realize in that whole situation is that it then took me and my father about 45 minutes to clean up all of the trash that had been spilled and to get our car back in order. And it then took another half an hour for my father to explain to an hysterical child about why this whole thing happened and why we weren't necessarily bad people for having this happen to us. And that was not the lesson I wanted to learn about what it was like to be a grown-up and go to work, but it was definitely the lesson that I did learn, because as time went on as an adult, I saw the same situations happen with my siblings and also myself, where the question doesn't really come off as a question, but more so feels like this is going to happen, and either you can comply and let it happen without things happening to you, whether it be legal or not, or you say no and face what may happen. And it wasn't until about, you know, my senior year of high school did I understand that you can say no to searches. And it takes a lot of time for us, even at CIO, to explain this to our members, because when you do immigrate here to the United States, you don't get training about what your rights are. You don't get that education, and it's up to life to teach you that lesson, or if you are a member of an organization to teach you that education. And so although we are a growing organization, we can't reach everyone in the state. And so this was something that we looked at through the ACLU and thought that this was a pretty good way of dealing with that situation, is to just slow down the conversation one step and say, you know, you have the right to say no without a fear of arrest. So that way, folks similar in my father's situation doesn't feel like their options are either say no and be arrested in front of your child or say yes and have another extra hour of cleaning to do that slows you down. I'm open for questions, but I'd like the other two to go first. Thank you.
That's my plan.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we do support Senate Bill 575, and we think it's just simply good government and good policy and good sense. We liken this a lot to the advice of Miranda warnings. And if you couple Miranda warnings with recorded interrogations, which we now have, it's very similar here to informed consent in the field with body cameras, and it's going to translate to the same thing. Miranda simply, at the time in 1966 when the Miranda decision came out, you have to inform somebody who's in custody, A, you have the right to remain silent, and B, you have the right to talk to an attorney before you say a word. You would have thought in the throes of that the world would come to an end because law enforcement was insistent they would never, ever, ever get a statement out of anyone being interrogated again. And to everyone's surprise, they kept talking. They keep talking. They get their statements. People cooperate with shows of authority. They just do. And so what happened in 2009, this legislative body passed a bill that required law enforcement to electronically record interrogations. When you've got someone in custody and you give them Miranda warnings, you turn on the recording device and you record that entire thing. What that translates to in the courtroom is you don't have a lot of dispute. It's now recorded. You now get to see it and hear it. They gave Miranda warnings. It was all accurate and true. He said yes. They kept talking. That statement comes in. So the way we are analyzing this bill is that now in this instance out in the field, it very much will look the same thing. There's a huge dispute every time there's a search and seizure. Was it consensual? You know, what were the circumstances? How was it phrased? What was going on around it? Where were the body, you know, where were the other officers? Where were the cars with the lights? Were you penned in, et cetera, et cetera? Now, if we have body cameras and dash cams and informed consent, there's going to be very minimal litigation arising from this. I maintain that people will continue to give consent. A lot of times you go and ask your client, why did you consent to that search in the car? You knew there were drugs in the car. Why did you consent? I don't know. They don't know. They consent. So it is important, I think, to let people at least understand they have that right. I love the way Representative Fredericks put it. Let's put the pause button on there. Just give them the information that exists. You have the right to refuse this. And I could have to go get a warrant if I've got probable cause, but you have the right to refuse the request. Very often the requests from the officers are phrased in such that technically it's a question. It just doesn't sound like a question, really. Do you mind if I take a look? Do you mind if I come on in? Do you want to step out of the car? Do you mind if I take a look quick? That's the way that all happens. And it's translated legally. If you say yes to that, that that's a consent to a search. But very often the person really is, quite frankly, yielding to a show of authority. So we just think it's good policy. It can't hurt to give citizens information that they have constitutional rights and they're being asked to waive them. It just can't hurt. And if you couple this with body cameras, we think it will make very clean adjudications in a court of law. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda?
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Linda Roman. I work for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I'm the health policy coordinator. Thank you for the time to provide testimony today. As the fabric of Oregon continues to change with the growing population of immigrants and refugees, it is important to ensure that we're all on the same page. It's important for us to know our rights, to know what is allowed, what is wrong, and what's our freedoms. The Oregon Latino Health Coalition is in support of Senate Bill 575 because we believe it's important that our interactions with the police and law enforcement are informed and safe. This is why this key information to have the right to decline the search is important for our community, important to know. Unnecessary escalations do not help anybody. We urge you to support this bill. Thank you very much for your time and your commitment to these communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
Yeah, quick question.
Senator Thatcher.
Will this also apply beyond vehicle searches?
Yes.
Because that wasn't, I thought so when you came into my office, Salome, that it did, but then I heard testimony earlier that made it sound like it was just for vehicle stops. So I just want to make it clear. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senator Thatcher, sorry, he switched off chambers on me. Yes, and so We do acknowledge, though, that most of the searches that do happen tend to be when folks are in vehicles, but yes, it would apply also if someone, if an officer was to go to someone's home or if they did a pedestrian stop of someone walking on the street.
Thank you.
Ms. Senator Burdick.
As a longtime member of the Judiciary Committee, I should know the answer to this, but are there any circumstances under which an officer can compel a search? Visible probable cause that can compel a search, and if so, how would the person know the difference?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, Senator Burdick, definitely if the officer has probable cause and then has exigent circumstances, then they can execute a search without consent and without a warrant. And so those are hugely variable circumstances that come and go. But definitely out there in the field, if the officer has probable cause to arrest someone, they can pat them down for officer safety. If they have probable cause and exigent circumstances to believe that there might be a dissipation of evidence, if they don't immediately seize something, then they can seize it. So there are instances when full search and seizure in the field is lawfully permitted. This really would cover those instances when they would have to rely on consent in order for the evidence to lawfully come in, because there was no other exception to the warrant requirement. So if they seized something pursuant to consent, let's see, how can I make this simpler? If they seized something based on some other exception to the warrant requirement, they could rely on those other exceptions to the warrant requirement in a court of law. Usually they rely on consent to search without consent, they'd have to have a warrant.
Mr. Chairman, what brought this up is the example that Salome offered with her father kind of reading into the statement by the police. So if someone is compelled to do a search, I think it's just as important to have that required as well. That if it is a legal search with exigent circumstances or whatever the criteria are, that should have to be in the information as well. That you are compelled to do this, your consent is not necessary. It was just a thought, Mr. Chairman, that to remove the ambiguity.
Yeah, and I think one of the things just maybe. When you look at the language that's being added on page 1, lines 21 through 22, an officer may not obtain consent to search by threatening an action that the officer know is unlawful. And so basically the way I interpret what we're looking at is, as Gail Myers said, if an officer doesn't have probable cause, does not have some other exception to the warrant, such as a car being mobile and the stuff that's in the car can be removed, and basically are asking for that consent. And once you get the consent, you don't need to worry about having any exception, because the consent is all the officer needs to go forward, because you've voluntarily, under the interpretation of the law, have given that officer the opportunity to conduct a search.
Right. And I guess, Mr. Chair, and I think that's a good point. I guess what my concern was in the case of the father, who was not that familiar with the country's laws and customs at the time, that they might misinterpret, that they might think they have rights that they don't, and they could get in trouble if they didn't understand fully that the search was compelled.
Right. Great. Any other questions or comments?
I'd just like to respond real quick. So with the situation with my father, my father did understand that the situation looked bad in terms of, it's a car at night at a closed facility leaving a place. And as a janitor, understands that he's moving around during times of night. But I think had the officer definitely said, you have the right to decline and you won't be arrested, he would have declined, seeing as that would have saved him the time, the energy, and also saved the interaction from me seeing interactions such as what I saw. But I think that having that option not given to him really, or understanding that he could say no, really left him with the idea that there was not a question being asked in the first place.
All right. Any other questions? All right, ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The last two I have scheduled is Doug Harcourt and Mike Sullivan. Gino, I know I always say that wrong. So.
Savaggio.
Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Who'd like to start off?
I'm happy to start, okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harcourt. For the record, I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I'm the part-time Executive Director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association and the part-time Senior Policy Advisor for the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, where I do basically research and writing. I come to you today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association to oppose Senate Bill 575. The president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Bob Herman, and one of his lawyers in Washington County filed a memorandum in opposition, which is on OLIS. And so if you haven't had a chance to read that, I would encourage you to do that. It's not very long, it's about 2 pages, and explains quite a bit. I do not intend to read that to you. I intend to just make a few points. Search and seizure is the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Constitution, which actually is a higher standard than the U.S. Constitution pursuant to the Supreme Court of the State of Oregon. Here's the manual. For the record, I'm holding up a manual from the Attorney General's Office on search and seizure. It looks to me to be an inch and a half or 2 inches thick, which summarizes the law in search and seizure. And we provide all of that to all of the prosecutors, and I think some of the police officers have this. There's a whole section on consent searches. This is a well-established area of the law. This is something, not something new. And consent searches must be freely and voluntarily done. If they are not, they are bad searches. And I heard testimony today that sounded to me like there were some bad searches going on that were not legal and would be thrown out if the evidence got to court. So the law requires that the court make a decision based on all of the facts and circumstances surrounding the particular search as to whether or not it was freely and voluntarily done. So, not to read very much, but to read a little bit. In deciding whether the state has satisfied the burden to prove that this consent was voluntary for the purposes of our Article 1, Section 9, the test is whether, under the totality of the circumstances, the defendant's consent was an act of free will or instead resulted from police coercion, either express or implied. And the testimony I heard earlier was all about implied coercion, which would be bad under Oregon law and would be not admissible in court, and it should not be. Frankly, we should scrupulously honor the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 9. What I believe is the vast majority of police officers, after my 34 years of experience, is that they scrupulously honor this. Okay? And so the courts are going to take a very careful look. I think I've hit that really hard. Now, let's assume for the moment that this proposed statute was passed. What happens? Ms. Meyer says, well, people will still consent and things will just go on. I'm not so convinced of that. I think there will be some people that will exercise that right not to consent. It will be mostly those who have contraband. And so we will have more contraband, methamphetamine or whatever it happens to be, in the community. So what we're really talking about here is balancing, in my mind. We're balancing whether or not the courts have done a good job over decades of analyzing consent searches and when they're okay to do under the constitutions of the United States and Oregon, or whether or not the legislature needs to step in and do more. My analysis is that the courts have done a good job. So let me switch here for a minute, because it was earlier mentioned about Miranda, 1966 decision. That, by the way, was not a statute. No legislature passed Miranda. That was a court decision. And just as the interpretation of Article 1, Section 9 and the United States Constitution are court decisions over decades, Miranda only applies, but it's okay, so it's a court decision. That's point one. Point two, Miranda only applies if somebody is in custody. For the non-lawyers, that's usually an arrest. Custody's a little more complex, and there's a whole bunch of court decisions about what custody is, but that means somebody is not free to leave. They've been, in all likelihood, arrested. When somebody is in an arrest status versus a non-arrest status, that's a completely different situation. Miranda makes perfectly good sense to me. It has, and Ms. Myers is right. People just, they hear those rights and then they talk for whatever reason, lots of different reasons. But, so Miranda is a court standard, just as the consent to search is a court standard, and the court has done a good job of that. So when I balance it, I would balance it, and I would not pass this statute. What I heard in earlier testimony sounded to me like a significant training issue, and it's much broader than this kind of a statute. Frankly, if there's police tensions with the community, this statute isn't going to solve the police tensions with the community. That's all I have.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. The coalition has concerns with the precedent and effects of Senate Bill 575 and opposes the measure. Most of my testimony is entirely contained within Mr. Harkleroad's testimony, so I'll just be brief and make a few notes. We feel that adding an additional technical loophole to the existing judicial process creates a higher probability that these and other cases will be overturned regardless of how well officers follow these procedures. It creates an incentive for any defendant to then claim that they were not properly informed. I'm going to echo the concern we had about the precedent of comparing this to Miranda, which applies only to those in custody already, and just leave you with while we understand the intent of these protections, the measure creates the slipperiest of all slopes, whereby legal technicalities begin accruing prior to an individual being placed in custody or arrested. Officers travel the streets and talk to people all the time, and I don't think anyone on this committee would suggest that before an officer said hello or engaged in a conversation, they had to Mirandize everyone that they talked to. So with that, I'll just leave you with the coalition's objection to the measure and turn it over for questions.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator Burdick first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harkleroad, you make a pretty good case that the courts are diligent about enforcing the consent provisions. When a matter gets to court, when the drugs have been found, the criminal action is brought. However, what about those other 80% of the cases where the people have no remedy at all? If their car is disrupted in the case of the trash, or they're detained maybe from an important appointment, there's nothing in the car, nothing is found, what remedy does that person have under the constitutional protections?
I'm Chair Prozanski, Senator Burdick. I'm not sure what remedy that person needs if the search was proper. If the search was improper and the consent was invalid, they can litigate that issue. But is that an adequate remedy? I suspect not.
Because I think the whole point of this bill is not in cases where something is found, but in cases where people are stopped and stopped and stopped, and there's nothing there, but they still have to spend an hour out of their time putting up with a search where nothing is found, where the search could have been prevented had they known that they had the right to prevent it.
Other questions? Senator Thatcher.
I'm just wondering, you're talking about more drugs being out in our community, perhaps, and I'm picturing that probably people who participate in and facilitate drug organization activities would probably be well instructed, I'm imagining, in what their rights would be, and so they're probably already refusing, or there would be warrants on them because there'd be some probable cause. But I'm thinking more likely that this would be applying to those who would be confused or just kind of like your everyday person, just kind of stopped for whatever reason and just not realizing. And I'm wondering, have you looked at what the other states that have adopted this? I think Colorado was mentioned, to see what their track record is. And it seems like perhaps when things get to court, if there was this clear consent, that maybe those cases might be a little more strong for the police officers than where it might be a little, I guess, questionable whether the searches were done correctly or not. I don't know. Just wondering if you've looked at that.
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher, to the question about other states, I have not personally done that, but there was a quick survey done, and what I was told is that 16 states don't have a statute like this. Colorado has something similar, but I haven't looked, so I can't tell you what the language of that is and how it compares. Regarding the what I think was the second question about would this help make the consents clearer in court? And this, I don't think, changes the test in court, which is the totality of the circumstances. I don't read that in Senate Bill 575 anywhere. Actually, I was surprised that on line 23, an officer's failure to do what the law, if this was passed, requires, doesn't throw out the consent. It's just a factor for the court to be considered during determination of whether the consent to search was provided voluntarily. So if the officer fails to do what the, assuming the statute became law, fails to say to the person that you have been asked to voluntarily consent and that you have the right to refuse to consent, and if the officer doesn't do that, all this statute says is consider that and whether or not it was a valid consent, looking at all of the other circumstances, seemed peculiar to me.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think that we would note our concern at, I think maybe above Mr. Huckerbode's, about the line 23 test. I think we have it on record from earlier today that the legislative intent is to create a prima facie evidence that, it was non-consensual. If in fact the officer does not correctly inform per the bill, so I think that we would our concern meter on that element would be turned a little higher up.
Right. So let me just Representative Vega Peterson basically said that she thought it was prima facie. My reading of the bill, it is not. It basically just keeps it as a totality of circumstances, but it is, I think, calling out for the court to be sure to take that in consideration, but it does not somehow preempt or make the search invalid based on the language that's there. Doug, did you have something else?
Chair Przanski, you just said it.
Okay. All right. So any other questions? All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Again, I'm going to ask, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 575. Seeing anyone coming forward, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing for Senate Bill 575. And what I'd like to do is ask counsel if you would. I know that Colorado was mentioned. I think you've already looked at that.
Yes.
I would like to have the actual statute provided to all of the members so they can see what and how it's actually written in Colorado. Okay. If there's any other states that you find that have something similar to that, that would be an interest for the chair. And then the other thing I guess I'd like for you to do, and I do see Kevin Campbell here, if there could be some type of just quick check in with the chiefs of police to see how many are doing something in this sense. I know that at least at one point state police was actually giving written consent forms out before they did searches to actually support that it was a voluntary consent. And so I'm just trying to find out what the meter is in across the state, what might be internal practices of different departments. All right.
It's reasonable.
Anything else we need to cover?
I don't think they should be drilling out here, but other than that.
Okay. All righty. So that takes care of that. I think tomorrow is Wednesday, and I believe we're here at 8:30. So we're adjourned for today, and we'll see those who are coming back tomorrow. And we'll see those who are coming back tomorrow. And for today.